KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. It looks like time's up for TikTok, or is it? The app's gone dark, but we'll tell you how the ban is playing out in the U.S. And we'll hear from voters about their hopes for the second Trump administration ahead of tomorrow's inauguration. Plus, the college football national championship game won't just feature the football players. Hear from the members of the team's marching bands about their halftime shows.
Especially before a night game, there's so much adrenaline. It's so exciting, and you really, really feel like you're a huge part of the experience.
It's Sunday, January 19th. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. A ceasefire is now in effect in Gaza after 15 months of war between Israel and Hamas. Three Israeli women were released a short time ago. The Israeli military says the Red Cross confirms it's received the hostages in Gaza and is transferring them to Israel. The three had been kidnapped on October 7, 2023, in the Hamas-led attack that started the war. They've been identified as Romy Gonin, Doron Steinbrecher, and Emily Damari, who also has British citizenship. The ceasefire also calls for the release of hundreds of Palestinians detained in Israel. Under the agreement, humanitarian aid will begin to flow into Gaza. NPR's Aya Betraoui has more.
Dozens of trucks have entered Gaza today, with many more expected to enter once Egypt's border with Gaza, the Rafah crossing, opens in the coming days as well. And Gaza needs everything right now, from temporary field hospitals to be built to more food kitchens to distribute meals. They need tents for people to sleep in, winter clothes, even fuel just to keep water pumps running so people can have clean water to drink.
NPR's Aya Betraoui reporting. President Biden is using his clemency power to pardon or commute the sentences of seven more people, adding to an historic roster. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
With just hours left in his presidency, President Biden issued pardons for five people, most of them convicted of nonviolent drug offenses, but one of them given posthumously was for Marcus Garvey, the early 20th century civil rights leader. Another is Don Scott, who was the first black speaker of the Virginia House of Delegates. President Biden also commuted the sentences of two people serving decades-long sentences Biden said they would not have received under current law. In a statement, the president said America is a country built on the promises of second chances. Biden has made more pardons and commutations than any other president in U.S. history. Mara Liasson, NPR News.
IRS Commissioner Danny Werfel says he'll resign tomorrow when President-elect Donald Trump is set to be inaugurated. NPR's Rafael Nam has more on the story.
Werfel said in a letter to employees it was time to leave 3 years before his term expires. Trump has picked former Republican Congressman Billy Long from Missouri as the next head of the IRS. Under Werfel, the IRS received billions of dollars in funding from the Inflation Reduction Act. The IRS has been using the money to modernize its antiquated IT systems. It also introduced a direct filing system and tried to improve the agency's customer service. And the IRS increased its enforcement against wealthy tax evaders. Republicans, however, have been trying to claw back the funding provided to the IRS. Rafael Nam, NPR News.
This is NPR News in Washington. President-elect Trump is in Washington for celebrations ahead of his inauguration tomorrow. He's scheduled to lay a wreath at Arlington National Cemetery today and address a rally of supporters downtown. The rally has been moved indoors because of cold weather. Trump will also take the oath of office tomorrow inside the Capitol Rotunda instead of outside on the steps. It's the first time the ceremony is being held inside since Ronald Reagan was sworn into office for his second term in 1985. Several religious leaders who've supported Trump are among those slated to offer prayers during his inauguration. NPR's Jason DeRose has more.
Franklin Graham, the son of famed evangelist Billy Graham, is scheduled to give the invocation before Trump's swearing in. Graham has been a vocal supporter of Trump during each of his runs for office. Also praying at the beginning of the ceremony, Cardinal Timothy Dolan, the Catholic Archbishop of New York. Scheduled to offer the benediction at the end is Rabbi Ari Berman, the president of Yeshiva University, along with several other clergy from around the U.S., including Imam Husham al-Husseini from Dearborn, Michigan. Al-Husseini is among the Muslim leaders who campaigned for Trump last year, in part to punish Democrats for supporting Israel's war against Hamas. Jason DeRose, NPR News.
Fire officials in Los Angeles say the largest of the wildfires burning since January 7th is now about 52% contained. The Palisades fire has burned more than 23,000 acres. The National Weather Service says strong winds are expected to return tomorrow. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at MelvilleTrust.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. It's just hours after the ceasefire between Israel and Hamas went into effect, and Israel's military says three Israeli women held by Hamas have now been released. For more, NPR's Greg Myrie joins us now from Tel Aviv. Welcome.
Hi, Aisha.
So, what can you tell us about these women, I guess we can say former hostages now?
Yes, that's right. These are three young civilian women, ages 24 to 31. All of them were taken on the day of the Hamas attack into southern Israel that started this war, October 7th, 2023. One was seized at the music festival that we've heard so much about. Two others at a kibbutz in southern Israel, just across the Gaza border. And they've been held now for 471 days, more than 15 months. Video showed this very chaotic release in Gaza City. They were surrounded by Hamas gunmen with automatic rifles and masks on, crowds in the streets surrounding them, but they were handed over to the Red Cross. The women were all able to walk. We don't want to speculate on their overall condition, but they could walk. The Red Cross then took them to the Israeli military. They were whisked out of Gaza. They're on their way to a military hospital in southern Israel for initial checkup, and then they're expected to go to a hospital in the Tel Aviv area for longer-term observation.
Do we know if any of the Palestinian prisoners or detainees have been released?
Apparently not quite yet, but we're expecting it at any moment. So the Israeli side of this, they're releasing 95 Palestinians. These are women and young men. Most are all are detainees who are not charged with any crimes. So this is the first batch of many that will be released as these exchanges play out for weeks to come.
There were problems, though, at the start of the day. What were they?
Yes, absolutely. So this ceasefire was supposed to take effect at 8:30 a.m. local time, but Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israel had not received the names of these three Israeli women who were being released, and this was part of the agreement. Hamas acknowledged this. They claimed it was an unspecified technical problem. Israel said this meant the ceasefire had not taken effect. It began carrying out airstrikes. Palestinian officials said at least 19 people were killed, so it looked like the deal might fall apart. But it did come together when the names were handed over, and it took hold about 11:15 in the morning. So we have seen Palestinian celebrations in Gaza, civilians waving flags, Hamas fighters waving guns. Also, many civilians are heading home. Many had fled areas multiple times, including in recent days, due to heavy Israeli bombing.
And how are these hostage and prisoner releases going to take place in the days ahead?
Yeah, so they're very staggered. So these three Israeli women got out today. In about another week, Hamas will release three more. This first phase of the agreement is 6 weeks long, and Hamas is going to release 33 of about 100 Israeli hostages. So it's very slow. It's very drawn out. On the Palestinian side, there's going to be close to 2,000 releases. This will run the gamut. It will include those who have not been charged and just been held a short time. It will include some Palestinians who've been convicted of murder and terrorism. And we really want to stress for both sides, these releases are hugely important, a big part of the ceasefire deal.
That's NPR's Greg Myrie in Tel Aviv. Thank you so much.
Sure thing, Aisha.
You may recall the swing states. All seven went in favor of President-elect Donald Trump last November, crucial wins on his return to the White House. So on the eve of his second term, we wanted to check in with residents there once more. How are they thinking about what's to come? We have reports from two of those key states, starting in Wisconsin.
I'm Mayan Silver here at the Industrial Chic Tap Room at Raised Grain Brewing Company, where people are decompressing from the work week, drinking beers like Utterly Perfect, a milk stout, and Frivolous Pursuit, a hazy IPA. It's located in Waukesha County, a Republican-leaning suburb of Milwaukee, where President-elect Donald Trump received nearly 60% of the vote in November. Pat Walsh is at a table in the back with two of his friends, dipping into a pepperoni pizza and drinking barley wine. He's wearing a part camouflage, part American flag, Trump 2020 Make America Great Again hat. He'll be eagerly watching the inauguration on Monday.
Well, I'm watching it. Looking forward to Daddy getting back in the White House instead of the kindergartners who have been running the show for the last 4 years.
Walsh wants Trump to do everything he's promised, from closing the border to reducing inflation to revamping the justice system. Walsh says he absolutely loves Trump's cabinet picks and says they show Trump's eyes are wide open this time. On the other side of the room, Pat Matushinek says he's also a Trump supporter. He says he's on a fixed income and has to pay attention to every dollar. He says of Trump's promises to reduce inflation,
not sure exactly how he's going to go about it, but I look at it this way, he can't do any worse than the previous administration that's going out.
He says he's not going to watch the inauguration because it's, quote, a big waste of money, and that politicians should spend for the people, not for themselves.
Well, hello, Waukesha Dems. I am really happy to be here.
About 5 miles away from Raised Grain, Judge Susan Crawford, the liberal-backed candidate in a state Supreme Court race that's scheduled for later this year, is stopping by a meet and greet with local Democrats. People here are taking Trump's return very differently. Yvonne Lumsden Dill is in the front row of the meet and greet, waiting for candidates to take the podium.
I am very afraid, as a minority, as a female, that all the things he's talking about with Roe versus Wade, abortion laws, immigrants and everything, I believe he's gonna be moving fast to get those things in place.
She says she has a genetic disorder, and the prescription to treat it used to cost $20,000 a year. Now it's capped at $2,000 a year under the Inflation Reduction Act.
For the first time, I'm feeling as if something that's going on in Washington, D.C. is going to hit me directly.
She's worried that even as Trump ran on pledges to improve the economy, on this particular issue, he'll reverse course. For NPR News, I'm Ayan Silver in Waukesha.
And I'm Steve Harrison in Charlotte, North Carolina. On a sunny, mild Friday afternoon, the Leatherman Golf Driving Range near the city's airport was packed. The inauguration was not top of mind. everyone agreed it was shaping up to be something of a non-event, especially compared to 4 years ago.
People are resigned to the fact that the Trump administration is going to be in office in a couple more days, and whether people supported him or not, it's what's going to happen.
That's Matt Lincoln, a Charlotte attorney. He declined to say whom he voted for, but he's pleased that this is shaping up to be just another swearing in.
The peaceful transition of power from one administration to the next is something that I think should be at the absolute bedrock of the way our government operates.
Kyler Eckert voted for Trump and is looking forward to the inauguration.
I'm definitely excited about it. Just from a economy standpoint, it'd be nice to see, you know, things go in a better direction than they've been going in.
He thinks the U.S.'s standing in the world will improve.
A little more respect, I guess, from other countries. I think that'll be good.
Trump won North Carolina, one of seven highly contested swing states. But Charlotte, the state's biggest city, is blue. It's in Mecklenburg County, which voted overwhelmingly for Vice President Kamala Harris. Alyssa O'Connell, who voted for Harris, was shopping with her husband and two children this weekend. She's not planning to watch Monday.
It's between being busy with kids, work, taking care of the house, and no, I'm not particularly excited about the next 4 years.
She's hoping Trump won't follow through with his campaign promises, such as deporting millions of people who are in the United States without legal status.
I think what we've seen from Trump is that he does like to make big statements, and then sometimes they follow through, and sometimes maybe he didn't mean them quite the way they come out. So no one's up in arms. People are ready.
Jody O'Neill, who's in her 20s, voted for Harris and is planning to watch part of Monday's ceremonies on her phone. She says Trump acts like a dictator. She's not optimistic about the next 4 years.
A lot of people have already seen it coming that he's talking about mass deportation starting next week. And so a lot of innocent people are going to get hurt during this. So
8 years ago, thousands of Charlotteans participated in a women's march in the city's downtown, and hundreds more went to Washington, D.C. This year, there are two protests scheduled, but both are expected to be small. For NPR News, I'm Steve Harrison in Charlotte.
Artificial intelligence is popping up in Google searches, chatbots, schools, and offices. Well, here's another use, spycraft.
Artificial intelligence can help find vulnerabilities in systems, exploit those, and also find what is most of interest.
The next James Bond may be lurking in Silicon Valley. You can hear that story later today on All Things Considered. Listen on your smart speaker, on your phone, or on the radio. You're listening to NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. The Israeli military says Hamas has released three Israeli women to the Red Cross in Gaza, and they're now back in Israel. They'd been held hostage since the Hamas-led attack on Israel in October of 2023. The release is part of a ceasefire agreement that went into effect today. South Korea's impeached president Yoon Sung-yeol was formally arrested today. His supporters stormed the courthouse where the arrest warrant had been issued, attacking police and smashing windows. And on his last full day in office, President Biden granted pardons to five people, including the late civil rights leader Marcus Garvey. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. For more than 75 years, AU has supported freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more at au.org/NPR. From American Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. TikTok has gone dark in the U.S. When users tried to open the app late Saturday night, they got a pop-up instead. It said, "Sorry, TikTok isn't available right now." But the ban may be short-lived for its 170 million American users. This morning, President-elect Donald Trump promised to issue an executive order on Monday, pushing the ban back. He wants to negotiate a deal that would give the United States 50% ownership of TikTok. For more, we're joined by NPR's Bobby Allen. Good morning.
Good morning.
So we've talked a lot about a TikTok ban, but now it's really here. Did this come as a surprise?
You know, I think a lot of TikTokers thought it would never really happen. And look, I sure do get that. Washington has been talking about a TikTok ban for years and years. But since Congress passed a law targeting TikTok in April and the Supreme Court last week upheld it, we have just been approaching this January 19th date. Now, TikTok pulling the plug did happen a little earlier than expected. It went offline somewhere around 9 p.m. East Coast time on Saturday, hours before the ban law was set to take effect. But this is a really remarkable moment, Aisha. I mean, this is the first time ever the U.S. has outlawed an entire social media network used by millions of Americans. So just got to note that.
So it's not possible to view videos on TikTok right now. How long is the app expected to be offline?
Yeah, that's the question on everyone's mind right now. President-elect Donald Trump said recently that he intends to pause the law for 90 days after he's sworn into office, but we'll see if that happens. Remember, under the law, the only way TikTok can be restored is if it completely cuts ties from ByteDance, its corporate parent company in Beijing. So that could mean a lot of things, including potentially selling TikTok's U.S. operation or reaching some kind of deal that fully walls off China from TikTok. Now, shortly after TikTok went dark in the U.S., Apple and Google removed the app from app stores. That means it can't be downloaded. It can't get updates. But for people who have it already, it stays on everyone's devices. It's just kind of a shell of an app. It's useless.
Yeah. So you mentioned possible ways of bringing TikTok back. So tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, well, if Trump pauses the law for 90 days, he could try to broker a deal for TikTok's U.S. operations to be sold away. But there's another possibility. It involves something called Project Texas, and it was a proposal to have Austin-based software company Oracle oversee Americans' data on TikTok. The plan started during Trump's first term. The Biden administration worked on it, but it eventually fell apart. So now it's possible that Trump could revive the agreement and say, that is enough to satisfy the law. TikTok seems confident that he will do something. The pop-up notification to users said Trump has promised to, quote, work with us on a solution to reinstate TikTok once he takes office. Please stay tuned.
So what's next for all the TikTok diehards out there?
Yeah, well, many of them obviously are quite upset this morning to wake up and see TikTok not working. You know, some people are hanging on to hope that this is just a really short-term shutdown. Many, though, even before the ban, have been looking at TikTok as a volatile app that might not be the best place to build community or try to maintain a business. So we're seeing content creators and small business owners migrating to other platforms like Instagram Reels, like YouTube Shorts or a China-based app known as Red Note. But if TikTok is restored, Aisha, I don't know. Maybe everyone will just come back. We'll just have to see.
We'll have to see. That's NPR's Bobby Allen. Thanks, Bobby.
Thank you.
Fire crews are still on the front lines battling the Los Angeles blazes, and California's Democratic state leaders are bracing for a different fight ahead, a potential clash with the administration of President-elect Donald Trump over disaster aid. From member station KQED in San Francisco, Marisa Lagos reports.
Trump has never shied away from mixing politics with natural disasters. In his first term, Trump's FEMA briefly refused to send aid to California for a series of wildfires, then reversed the decision after direct appeals to the president. And speaking at his Palos Verdes Golf Club in September, then-candidate Trump falsely claimed that LA is in a drought because Governor Gavin Newsom won't send water south from Northern California in order to protect the Delta smelt, a tiny endangered fish. But LA gets most of its water from other sources, not the Northern California Delta, which has been the focus of fights between Central Valley Farms and environmentalists. Trump says unless Newsom changes course,
we won't give him money to put out all his fires. And if we don't give him the money to put out his fires, he's got problems. He's a lousy governor.
At the time, Trump's threats to withhold aid were theoretical. But now, with one day until he's sworn in for a second term, Newsom and others are concerned that Trump will make good on his promises. Here's the governor on the ground in the first 24 hours after the fires broke out.
My message to the incoming administration, and I'm not here to play any politics, is please don't play any politics.
Newsom's concern isn't just rooted in past statements either. In the days after the deadly fires broke out, amid bone-dry conditions and hurricane-force winds, Trump hosted more than half a dozen social media statements blaming Democrats for the fires and again falsely tying the urban blazes to Delta water supplies. But Republicans in California, like GOP Assemblymember Bill Assaley, say Democrats are overreacting.
I don't believe President Trump will punish the people of California for the inactions or incompetence of the leaders of California. I don't think that's going to happen. I do think the president-elect is going to pressure the government, both state and local, to change their policies and the way they do business.
But tying disaster aid to policy changes would be a dramatic break from U.S. tradition. Michael Wara, an energy and climate expert at Stanford University, says it's a terrible idea.
I think it's really important that we push back against politicization of disaster aid, no matter where the disaster is.
Still, Newsom and other state leaders are trying to walk a fine line, hoping that Trump's bluster is just that. In a recent letter to Trump, Newsom invited the president-elect to come to LA to see the damage. California Democrats are also making contingency plans, looking to immediately approve $2.5 billion in state funds for fire response and recovery, as well as $50 million more to fight the Trump administration in court if they need to. California Attorney General Rob Bonta, a Democrat, says he also supports Newsom's proposal to set aside billions more, just in case Trump refuses to provide aid in the future.
Maybe we'll never need it, but because doubt has been cast as to whether federal disaster relief funding will be forthcoming, we can't be caught flat-footed. We should be prepared.
No one here knows what Trump will actually do once he takes the oath tomorrow. On Saturday, he told NBC's Kristen Welker that he will probably visit at the end of the month after he's sworn in as president. For NPR News, I'm Marisa Lagos in San Francisco.
What's beef? Well, usually it's rappers trading barbs against one another in songs, and in some cases, even trading physical blows. But the beef between superstar rappers Drake and Kendrick Lamar has taken a different path. On Wednesday, Drake filed a new lawsuit in a U.S. court related to the dispute. We'll get to the details in a moment, but Lamar's lyrics and the fallout were pretty rough. When you need a few dollars, no, you're not a colleague, you're a colonizer. Still, Drake didn't sue Lamar. He's going after his own record label. Joining me to bring us up to date is Sydney Madden, a reporter for NPR Music. Welcome.
Hey, Aisha.
So, you know, the song, Not Like Us, it came out last year. Remind us what all the hype was about. Like, what went down with this song?
Not Like Us is a Kendrick Lamar song that dropped last May, and it was one of the biggest tracks of the year, pulling in billions of streams. They not like us. They not like us. They not like us. It's actually a diss track against Drake. In the song, Kendrick goes at Drake for a few different reasons, and he notably calls him a pedophile. Certified lover boy, certified pedophiles. This is an allegation that Drake has said is false, and he denied it in the lawsuit that we're going to talk about. But first, the impact of Not Like Us has gone way beyond a rap beef between two rap adversaries. It propelled Kendrick into dropping his latest album in November, and it was the fastest rap album to reach a billion streams last year. Now, looking ahead, the song itself is nominated for a few Grammys, and Kendrick is going to be performing at the 2025 Super Bowl. So he's gained a lot of shine and a lot of traction off this track.
But the lawsuit that Drake is bringing is not about the song itself. That's what I thought at first. It's about more than that.
Yes. What's of note here with this lawsuit is it's not about the actual song. That's not what Drake's lawyers are accusing of being defamatory. It's how the label, Universal Music Group, used the song. The lawsuit alleges that Drake and Kendrick's parent label released, heavily promoted, and mobilized around the song in a way that put Drake's life and livelihood in immediate danger. The filing says UMG removed the song's copyright restrictions on YouTube and Twitch to allow people to republish it more broadly. The lawsuit alleges that UMG did all this in order to damage Drake's reputation and back him into a corner to get him to re-sign a deal with them that would be more favorable to the label. UMG is denying the claims that Drake makes in his lawsuit about the nature of releasing and promoting the song.
So we should make a note here that the lawsuit references coverage of this beef by many journalists, and your coverage for NPR is among the stories mentioned, Sydney. But, like, there's a long history of rappers disparaging each other's in songs, you know, and really going at each other. But it usually doesn't end up going down this sort of legal route. Like, what makes this move different from what normally happens when rappers are going at each other?
This is definitely an escalation in their conflict between the two of them. But this also sets a new precedent for rap beef in general. I've studied a lot of lyrical content being used as evidence in court before, but in this case, we've never seen a rap star sue their own label for dropping a diss track that wasn't in their favor. Rap beef, at its worst, it can definitely escalate to violence between artists or other people. And according to details in the suit, Drake is saying that's what's happening. For example, the complaint alleges that because the cover art of Not Like Us features an aerial view of his home and it has drop pins that denote that sex offenders live in that home, there have been attempted home invasions that Drake has had to deal with in the last year. The suit also says that Drake has had to pull his child out of school and relocate him because of the accusations.
And let's remember, though, this song was a part of a back and forth between Drake and Kendrick. So they were both releasing songs going at each other at the time. And Drake made some very serious claims against Kendrick as well, like during this beef. I mean, it just makes me think, like, hip hop wise, like, is there something that's too far for a diss record? Like, what crosses the line?
It's an interesting question because the name of the game is to embarrass your opponent into submission when it comes to rap beef. And historically, there's been no line. It's no holds bars. So you think about other tracks like Tupac's Hit 'Em Up. You claim to be a player, but I'm your wife. We bust on bad boys for life. Or Nas, Ether. What you think you getting girls now because of your looks? Negro, please. Huh. You know mustache having with whiskers like a rat compared to beans you whack. When we talk about what crosses the line, I think it comes down to the level of bruising the ego that moves somebody to go from words to actions. So for Notorious B.I.G. and Tupac back in the 90s and many other rap beefs since then, the action was physical violence. With Drake, the action is a civil lawsuit.
And we haven't seen this before. Like, could there be an impact on the industry depending on how this lawsuit plays out?
When diss tracks are dropped on streaming platforms instead of in unofficial releases, freestyles, or mixtapes, like, money is involved, right? And thinking about how hip-hop has become such a big business, Drake is going after the business end of the conflict instead of the creative, instead of the music itself. So if he were to be successful in this suit, it would likely change the rules of engagement for how diss tracks can be released via the label machine.
That's Sydney Madden. She's a reporter for NPR Music. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Today is National Popcorn Day, but it might surprise you to learn that popcorn wasn't always seen as the ultimate movie snack. In fact, a century ago, popcorn was banned from the cinema. A saleswoman from Kansas City, Missouri, was one of the first vendors to bring the tasty treat into the theaters. And she built a concession empire in the middle of the Great Depression. Mackenzie Martin from member station KCUR has the story.
Hi, I ordered my tickets online.
At a small independent movie theater, you can smell the buttery aroma of popcorn before you even walk in.
If a building didn't smell like popcorn and I went in to watch a movie, I'm questioning where I'm at.
This is Greenland Armor owner Adam Roberts, who naturally swears they have the best movie theater popcorn in town.
Our popcorn is particularly good because we use a butter-flavored salt that makes it aromatic. That is what you smell when you're outside down the street.
Today, it's almost unthinkable to see a film without popcorn, which is why it's pretty crazy that 100 years ago, popcorn wasn't even allowed in movie theaters.
It would have been very unusual prior to the 1930s if anybody started selling popcorn in lobbies.
This is Professor Andrew F. Smith, author of Popped Culture, A Social History of Popcorn in America. He says back then, if you even tried bringing a bag of popcorn into the movies, you'd be asked to kindly check it at the door. See, the movie palaces of the 1910s and 20s were these grand, beautiful structures with ornate ceilings. Going to the movies was a formal affair. It was certainly not the kind of place where you could bring in cheap, messy street food.
They had rugs on the floor, and they didn't really want people coming in and eating things.
But when the Great Depression forced movie theaters to close by the thousands, the remaining owners became desperate for new sources of revenue. An obvious solution stood just outside, snack-slinging street vendors. They figured, why not make some of that money themselves?
The goal was to get people into the theater, so your cost of admission was relatively low. You wanted to make money on your concession stand.
Fragrant, buttery popcorn proved particularly profitable because you could smell it even before seeing it. And unlike sugar, popcorn wasn't rationed during World War II.
It really saved theaters during the Depression.
Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Smith says we'll never know who first brought popcorn inside the theater, but a Kansas City widow named Julia Braden is certainly in the running for the title. In a 1931 profile, Braden told the Kansas City Star she opened her first popcorn stand inside the Linwood Theater in 1915. That's 14 years before the Great Depression. By the time it was widespread practice, Julia Braden had already built a small empire. She had four stands around Kansas City, all inside or near movie theaters.
Popcorn sales just generated because of people like Julia Braden, and they made a lot of money compared to a lot of other people.
Braden claimed she was making about $15,000 a year, which is the staggering equivalent of more than $300,000 today. At the national chain B&B Theaters, based in Liberty, Missouri, co-president Bobby Bagby Ford says that concessions, and popcorn specifically, is still a movie theater's largest source of revenue.
There is the sensory overload of walking in and smelling fresh popcorn, going into the theater, the crunch of it while you're enjoying something and escaping together.
So you could say popcorn saved movie theaters in the 30s, and nearly a century later, it's still keeping theaters around. For NPR News, I'm Mackenzie Martin.
Mm-hmm. This is NPR News.
President-elect Trump will be inaugurated on Martin Luther King Day. On this holiday, we'll be discussing how the soon-to-be president's proposed policies have evolved in the last 8 years and what Senator Raphael Warnock, who is a pastor at the same church Martin Luther King preached at, tells us about what he's learned from King's teachings on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Three Israeli hostages are now back in Israel. They were released by Hamas hours after a ceasefire deal went into effect, pausing the 15-month war. The popular video app TikTok went dark in the U.S. last night. A new law required its Chinese parent company sell it to someone else or be banned in the U.S. President-elect Trump says he'll issue an executive order to delay a ban. And the National Weather Service is expecting Santa Ana winds to return to Southern California tomorrow, complicating firefighting efforts. Several major wildfires in Los Angeles County have been burning for 12 days. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Cunard, sailing to destinations worldwide on Queen Mary II, Queen Victoria, Queen Elizabeth, and Queen Anne, with the goals of relaxation, indulgence, and adventure. Learn more at Cunard.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. The inauguration of President-elect Trump highlights one of the divides in his coalition. Trump's guest list includes Elon Musk, who was a huge contributor to his campaign, and other tech billionaires who donated to the ceremonies. Our colleague, Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep, spoke to another Steve who's been speaking out against those billionaires. Hi, Steve Inskeep.
Good morning, Aisha Roscoe.
So the other Steve is Steve Bannon, who I'm familiar with because I covered the first Trump White House. He was a close advisor then for some of the administration. What's he doing now?
He's supporting or pushing Trump from the outside. You will recall Bannon cheered on Trump's effort to overturn his 2020 election defeat. He ultimately spent 4 months in prison for refusing to cooperate with a congressional investigation of the January 6th attack on the Capitol. He's out now. I went to see him in a D.C. townhouse where he does many, many, many hours of live streaming right-wing programs. And I went to see him because he illustrates that divide you mentioned. He says he's populist for the working class, which is what a lot of Republicans say now. And in his telling, at least, the tech billionaires at the inauguration are oligarchs. Use the same term that President Biden used in a farewell address the other day. One of their differences is on immigration. Trump has promised to crack down on people who are here without legal status, but people in his coalition disagree over legal immigrants, including people with H-1B visas, these high-skilled workers like computer engineers who are brought in by U.S. firms.
And Elon Musk favors those H-1B visas and says they bring in talent for America and, you know, help his companies.
Yeah, which Bannon explicitly says he doesn't want. He's like, why would America want more talent? Use the people who are here. Just says it right out loud. He's pushing back on these same billionaires. Bannon contends they are attending the inauguration not because they're in charge, but because they're trophies who surrendered. And he even speaks that way about Elon Musk, who contributed so hugely to Trump's win.
I think Elon Musk has, if with President Trump, I think he has very little power, has some influence, but has very little power, and I can be specific. First off, these oligarchs are completely created by the Democratic Party and the Lords of Easy Money. Remember, for the last 4 years, they had no problem at all with the oligarchs until they flipped and surrendered after we won. Elon Musk came a little earlier, and he came earlier because he saw the writing on the wall. He's a smart guy. He could see actually the true polling and saw where this is going. So he's the first man out. But Zuckerberg came and surrendered afterwards. Bezos came and surrendered afterwards. Mark Andreessen came and surrendered afterwards. Maybe Andreessen gave a little money in the run-up. They saw the game was over. The Democratic Party used them all to suppress us.
Bannon's using the term oligarchs, but he did go to Harvard Business School, worked at Goldman Sachs, produced Hollywood films. Does his own biography complicate this populist message?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, although he draws on his working class roots. There's some contradictions, but he does contend he wants a more equal society. And in fact, Bannon contends he wants to raise taxes on the wealthy.
I proposed that in 17. The Wall Street Journal reported it in an editorial that said they got to get Bannon out of the White House. He's a radical.
He did propose higher taxes. Trump didn't do that then. Is not proposing to raise taxes on the wealthy now, that's for sure. And this led me to a question. What will you think and do a year or two from now if it turns out that the people you see as oligarchs end up getting the lower taxes they want and many other things that they want and you don't get what you think
we are
you want?
Battle-hardened. This movement is battle-hardened. Because we were put up against the wall in 2021, okay?
Do you think it's possible that that will happen, that Trump will end up siding with them, that Congress will end up siding with them?
We will win because we're relentless. We don't quit.
He says he's going to push Trump further to the right.
Well, there are a lot of people who think Trump can be influenced, flattered, or persuaded.
Yeah, well, that may be one of the reasons the billionaires are at the inauguration, but Bannon says he will be influencing Trump, too.
NPR Morning Edition host Steve Inske. Steve, thank you so much.
Oh, glad to do it.
And you can hear more of Steve's interview with Steve Bannon on Morning Edition tomorrow. Looking for a good drama to kick off the new TV season? Maybe one set in a hospital? There's The Pit on Max.
52 in the waiting room, and it's not even 7.
What about a sitcom? Check out St. Dennis Medical on NBC.
And Mr. Lasky wants morphine, oxy, and Vicodin. He asked if we had a menu, and I said I didn't think so.
That's a party.
What if your vibe is more doctors on a luxury cruise? There's a show for that, Dr. Odyssey, on ABC.
You must be my brilliant nurses.
We are the ship's brilliant and capable nurses, yes.
Of course. I'm sorry.
And also a drama about a doctor who herself lands in the hospital, Doc on Fox.
You were an incredible doctor. You saved hundreds of lives.
You're the reason I became a doc.
So why are viewers so interested in dramas about doctors, especially when we all aim to avoid the hospital in real life? Here to make a house call is TV critic Catherine Van Arendonk of New York Magazine. Welcome.
Thanks so much.
Why are there so many medical dramas on TV? It's not like there are a bunch of like medical movies.
Yeah, that's true. You know, TV has this very particular rhythm. And what tends to make a really great television show is the specific combination of something that feels brand new every episode and something that feels very familiar and reliable. And there's really no better route to that combination than the medical show, because you can be connected to these doctors, you can care about their lives, you can be interested in who's sleeping with who or whether or not they are doing better or worse at their jobs. But there is this immediate and sort of obvious constant influx of novelty at the same time, because you have new patients every day. And it's part of why TV just cannot escape medical dramas.
Well, and do you find kind of echoes in these shows, like similar plots and storylines? A lot of these medical shows are plagued by the worst diseases. Like, these doctors catch the worst of it.
That's what I've noticed.
They do, yeah. I mean, I am always fascinated by the lines of dialogue that you'll get on a very long-running medical show, something like Grey's Anatomy that's been on for seasons and seasons, where the doctors have to, occasionally there'll be these lines like, can you believe that we've been through the bombing and the helicopter crash and the plague, and now we have to deal with this? But that's also not that far from the reality of doctors in traumatic situations. There's this immediate adrenaline junkie quality to that job, or at least particularly when you're located in these super intense medical situations like the Pit, which is in this emergency department.
Is there a show in this bunch that really stands out for you? You mentioned the Pit just then.
Yeah, I really love The Pit. I am thrilled to see it on television for a bunch of different reasons. One is that, for me, the kind of creme de la creme medical drama, and in fact, for me, one of the best TV shows of all time, was ER, this beautiful primetime drama about doctors in an emergency department in Chicago. And The Pit really echoes that in both metaphorical ways or more thematic ways. It's you're back in an emergency department. You have the sort of intense rhythm of both very small cases and very large cases happening all the time. There's also more literal echoes. It is once again led by Noah Wiley, who is one of the lead characters on ER. So it feels very familiar in that regard. But I'm also really happy about The Pit as a streaming show in a way that streaming has really not played with very much before in its original programming. It's a procedural. And although people watch procedurals on streaming all the time, they're almost always older shows that have been licensed to show up on Netflix. The Pit is one of the first shows like this that to me really feels excellent and has a long episode run for its first season, and that I'm hoping streaming gets even more behind in the future.
Any standout shows from the past? I know you mentioned that you love ER.
Yes, I love ER endlessly, and I think it is not just worth going back to because it's a great drama that I think really stands up to what TV feels like right now, but it also has so many different eras. Because that show was on for so long, the cast changes quite a bit over the course of it. I also want to encourage people to check out St. Denis Medical, which we mentioned earlier. It's a new sitcom on NBC from the creator of Superstore, which is another show that I really admire. And it is less of the sort of urgent and gross medical stuff, although it is still in that setting. And it is more about the economic reality of medical spaces in this country right now, the incredible pressure from the administration, the understaffing, and the way that that leads to interpersonal drama and humor and absurdity. And it's just enough of that kind of black humor because you are in these life and death scenarios, but they are also just people, this is their everyday life.
That's Catherine Van Arendonk, a TV critic at New York Magazine. Thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely my pleasure. Thanks so much.
The college football national championship is tomorrow, so we wanted to catch up with the students who will take to the field and shine in the spotlight.
My name is Hallie Keene. I'm studying economics and Spanish, and I'm a senior at the University of Notre Dame.
I am Clayton Callender. I'm a third year at Ohio State, and I'm studying economics.
And no, they're not on the football team. They're in the marching bands. Keene is the president of Notre Dame's Band of the Fighting Irish, where she also plays clarinet. Callender is the drum major for the Ohio State University marching band.
I'm the guy who wears the big tall hat and does the backbend in pregame, comes down the ramp. I do a lot of twirling and performing, just kind of all over the place and trying to entertain the crowd.
Both bands will perform at halftime in front of 70,000 fans and millions more watching at home. But Callender and Keene say they're not letting the pressure get to them.
It really is helpful that you're doing it alongside 300 of your closest friends. Like with any performance, it really is just you have to turn those nerves into excitement.
When the pressure is the highest, you're just going to fall back on your preparation and your practice. So we prepare very, very hard, very seriously. because of that, whenever the lights are the brightest and everyone's looking at us, then you just go back to what you know.
Pressure and big crowds are nothing new for Keene and Callender. Both Notre Dame and Ohio State play in stadiums that seat over 80,000 fans. And when it comes to making fans rock, both bands know what it takes. Play those classics.
My personal favorite would probably be this one song that we do called Celtic Chant. And it almost sounds like a war chant. We make the shape of a leprechaun while marching down the field. And in Notre Dame Stadium, we start kind of at the far end for this song. And then by the time we finish it, we're right in front of the student section. And so I just love playing that because you really feel the energy from the crowd around you.
At Ohio State, turns out it's the state of Ohio's official rock song, the 1965 classic by the McCoys, Hang On Sloopy.
I think Hang On Sloopy really gets the crowd going. They, you know, get the O-H-I-O chant. And I love twirling to Hang On Sloopy, performing to Hang On Sloopy. It's a great, great song. Everybody loves it. So that's probably my favorite one.
Now, those songs get the crowds going. But for these two, they have their own favorite moments. Keen says hers is right before kickoff, when the heart rate goes up and it's almost showtime.
Especially before a big game, especially before a night game where you're running out to lights and a stadium full of 80,000 or however many people. It's just, there's so much adrenaline. It's so exciting, and you really, really feel like you're a huge part of the experience.
Callender's favorite moment?
I would say dotting the I.
It's the Ohio State University after all, and the band is famous for its marching formations when the band moves across the field to create shapes and letters. Their most famous is Script Ohio, when band members are in constant motion, all coming together to spell O-H-I-O in cursive. And yeah, someone needs to dot that I.
Not only is it something that I've always wanted to do, but it's a different sousaphone player every time when we dot the I. And so I get to lead out somebody else and allow them to live out their lifelong dream as a sousaphone player of dotting the I. So it's kind of just, it's very special for me to be able to be a part of somebody else's dream, not just my own.
Hold up now. Hallie Keen says Notre Dame also has game when it comes to making shapes.
In the Notre Dame band, we'll group up in teams of four that are ranks, and so you're kind of, you know your spot on the field because there's this system with all these numbers and where you're supposed to go, and you're just following three other people who play the same instrument as you.
But Ohio State's approach is more individual, says Callender.
When you're making complex formations, everybody has a different thing to do. You're not following anybody, so everybody needs to know exactly where they go, not where anybody else goes. There's 192 people that need to all be in sync.
No matter who wins the game tomorrow, both band members have reason to celebrate.
Genuinely just rooting for my team. No matter what happens, I'm just really excited to be there in that environment. Certainly this is going to be like no other.
I've been a part of some big games. I don't think there's anything like the national championship game, so I'm just really excited to be able to go and see what the pinnacle of college football really feels like.
That's Clayton Callender of The Ohio State University and Hallie Keen of the University of Notre Dame. You can catch them both performing during tomorrow's college football national championship halftime show. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. From Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool, customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. and from the sustaining members of this NPR station.